Welcome to the Ontario Library Association Forest of Trees kickoff plenary this morning. I'm sure everyone in the room is very familiar with the Forest of Trees, and I felt like a tree in the forest this morning when I woke up, you know, fuzzy, bushy. We had to get up awfully early to be here for breakfast at 7, and those of you that weren't staying in one of our hotels last night, I applaud you, because we had a wonderful turnout at 7 o'clock for breakfast. And here we are. This session is about 45 minutes long. It goes quite quickly, and we are discovering that it's not as well orchestrated as we might have thought, and we're not going to worry about that, because spontaneity is often where you get your best fun from in a session. So the way we're going to do this, I'm going to say about 5 minutes the opening remarks, and then I'm going to introduce the winners from each one of our trees, starting with the blue spruce and moving through to the white pine. Each of you will have about 5 minutes or so, and we'd love to hear how you got your ideas, where you came from, you know, how you felt getting up this morning, whatever it is. Whatever it is, if I know our crowd, at least from the school libraries, we just eat up all those little details so that we can share them with all our learners that come through, and I'm sure it's no different in all the other venues that we share our wonderful Canadian authors' stories. At 9 o'clock, we move then to In Conversation in 206D, for blue spruce and silver birch. And then later this afternoon, there's another session and in conversation. And I know Dawn Aker will be there. Because of a mix-up, Nora wasn't aware until she arrived this morning that she was expected there, and she has other plans. So I'm apologizing publicly on behalf of some misunderstanding, which very well could have been mine and I didn't know it. One of my favorite sayings these days is, "What you don't know what you don't know." So if I was supposed to do something, I didn't know it, and I didn't do it. And I don't want Nora to feel badly because I didn't do what I'm supposed to be doing. Okay. As you know, this is year two of the Forest of Reading, and we have now reading opportunities right across the spectrum from the very young. And our latest tree, the Evergreen Program for Adult Readers, actually is being kicked off here at this conference. There has been a committee hard at work this year gathering suggestions from the public. That's how their larger list was started. The other programs, of course, we go to published within the last three publishing seasons, more or less, and we hone those down to a list, and that's how each of these programs works. And I applaud all of the hundreds, almost, of people who are involved in the selection committees and the steering group committees to make the reading programs work. I'm floored. The more I learn about this, my hat is off to all of you. The way that the Evergreen worked was to gather suggestions from the public as they went into various public libraries across the province. Criteria were much the same in that they needed to be Canadian materials. But then that committee honed a list, a large list of 30 or 40, and then they had a meeting yesterday and selected their short list, which will be announced at a session tomorrow morning. So that's called the Evergreen Program. I'd like you to know a little bit about the numbers of folks that we touch in the various programs. So last year, we had over 3,000 sites across the province register. And in those sites, we had almost 200,000 people reading. And of course, not everyone who reads votes. We actually had 130,000, roughly, who voted in one of the programs. And so that's touching a lot of people. How many heard Craig Kielberger yesterday morning? Just for those who did not hear what he had to say, he told us that he got his start in a public library, his start in social activism, where one librarian led him to some resources that mushroomed his inquiry frame of mind, and that he said that one intervention with one librarian touched thousands and millions of people around the world because it got him started. So I'm talking 130,000 voters, and I think that's wonderful, but we just don't have any idea who's following behind that. And all these wonderful books, of course, go down and get read year after year after year after year, and not just in our reading programs. So for everyone, the authors, the selectors, the steering group folks, the audience, the readers, the people who bring all these people together, you know, pat yourself on the back and have a little tug of heart for what wonderful work that you are doing. At this point, I'd like to start with the Stanley's Party. The Stanley's Party, the 2004 winner of the Blue Spruce Award. And I'd like to call on Linda Bailey and Bill Slavin. And who wants to go first? Is it ladies first? Or okay, come on up. Tell us about Stanley's Party, how it came to be, what you'd like to tell us about Stanley. Thank you, Linda.
Good morning. I love these tree awards. I love how they keep you keep planting new ones each year, and now you have a forest. I love how they have spread like weeds across the country. Out in BC, where I live, it's the Red Cedar Awards. In Saskatchewan, the Willow Awards. In the Maritime Province, the Hackmatack Awards. It's the Ontario Library Association that dropped all of these seeds. And so I think you're kind of like the Johnny Appleseed of Canadian children's literature. I especially love the Blue Spruce. The Blue Spruce was new to me last year. I happened to be out here on voting day, and I was doing school visits. There were a couple of things that really knocked me out that day. One of them was the ballot box. And what knocked me out was there wasn't just one ballot box. There actually were a whole row of ballot boxes. One for each nominated book, and they had Xerox copies of the covers of the books on the boxes. And this puzzled me for a little while until I asked the teacher librarian about it, and she explained that it was because some of the readers were too young to read a ballot, and so they voted by the pictures. And I found that absolutely amazing, that kids who were at such an early stage of reading that they were just really learning to decode were already voting in the Reader's Choice Award. I thought that was amazing. The other thing that hit me was how little these guys were when I looked around. And I figured this is probably the first time in their entire lives that they had actually formally voted. And when you put those things together, you have, on the one hand, you have voting, which is this huge, important, powerful thing. And on the other side, you have reading, which is also this huge, big, important, powerful thing. And what the Blue Spruce does is it puts those two things together at that very young age, at that very early time in a child's life. And how powerful is that? We can only imagine. As for Stanley's Party, well, this book began, as many books do, in real experience. I have a dog. My dog's name is Sophie. She's a 6-year-old golden retriever. And in all of those 6 years, I have never, ever once seen my dog on the couch. She's been trained not to go on the couch. She's not allowed there. However, when everybody goes out for the day, or out for any length of time and leave the dog alone, we come back. It's not uncommon to see golden hairs all over the dark green couch. They're really easy to see. And sometimes the couch is still warm. And sometimes up in the back of the couch, there are dog toys. So it's easy to see what's going on there. And so I did what writers do with that, with the real experience. I took that experience, I extrapolated, I exaggerated, and I began to riff on it. I began to wonder what else that dog was getting up to when no one was home. I wondered if she might be able to turn the music on. The button's not that hard to press these days. I thought, well, maybe she could actually, if she worked at it, get her nose in that seal on the fridge and pop the fridge door open. In talking about Stanley's party later, people have come up to me afterwards and told me they had dogs that actually could do both those things. So it wasn't as unlikely as I thought. And then if she could get food and music happening, I thought it was possible she might want to invite a few friends over. And that's how Stanley's party began. I was extremely lucky to be matched by my publisher, Kidscan Press, with the fabulous Bill Slavin here, who did the art. And I have to say that I think that Ontario primary age kids must have very discerning taste in art. Because often the books that are chosen by children are not necessarily the books that are chosen by discerning, knowledgeable adults when they are the ones who give out the awards. But in this case, Bill Slavin, who would be far too modest to tell you this, last year also won the Amelia Frances Howard Gibbons Award for Stanley's Party as Illustrator of the Year, chosen by the Canadian Library Association. So Canada's librarians love Bill's art, and Ontario's kids love Bill's art. And I guess the moral of the story is that even if you're little, you can still be very, very sophisticated. It was a great thrill last year to receive this award with Bill. It's a thrill to be here today, and I'm having a very, very good time in your forest. Thank you.
And now I'd like to call on Bill to give his perspective on Stanley's party. Bill?
Good morning. Well, I guess now I don't have to tell you about all the good things that I won last year. Thanks to Linda. I scraped that off my speech. as the only illustrator in this group, I think that's right anyway, I was given to understand from one of the organizers of this event that I'm here representing the entire gamut of Canadian children's illustration. That was a sort of an overwhelming thing to be told, and therefore I always wanted to shy immediately from impossible tasks. I'm going to retreat into a fairly safe harbor and talk about something that I do know, and that is Stanley. I was first introduced to Linda Bailey's doggy creation a few years ago via a faxed manuscript, and I have to admit that I had no idea he would win as many hearts or awards as he has. Linda and I had worked on a number of titles prior to Stanley. The first few books in the Good Times Travel Agency series were already under our belts, and in her work I discovered an author with whom I felt there was this wonderful chemistry. I liked the way she saw the world, and I found her writing actually laugh aloud funny, which isn't an easy sort of writing to do. And because the Good Times books were heavily scripted by the author, with lots of art direction coming from Linda herself, which is completely unlike picture books where the illustrators left to their own devices, I had also learned that she and I shared a similar visual imagination, which made the meshing of our two crafts quite painless. At least most of the time it was, anyway. And that's a really, really important thing, obviously, that chemistry when you're creating picture books. I think right from the start, Lynn and I shared the view that Stanley, although he gets into situations that we may recognize as being the sort of transgressions our children might do, that he was, at the end of the day, 100% dog. I think it is that very dogginess in a slightly anthropomorphized way that makes him so immediately recognizable and lovable, both to dog lovers, God bless them, and those who just enjoy a good tale. I get the sense sometimes that Stanley is never far from Linda's imagination. When we get together in Vancouver, she's taking me on little tours of a city she knows well, and on these trips she points out the views and locations she has peopled with future Stanley tales, and so there'd be a beach here and a bridge there, and Stanley just seems to be everywhere. I haven't told her this, but it's all a great waste of time on her part, of course. You know, it's trying to subvert my future Stanley imaginings in such an overt way. Being an Ontario boy born and bred, Stanley is firmly grounded in the architecture and world of my own imagination, which sadly, doesn't have a lot of oceans and mountains. That's not to say that future tales won't have oceans and mountains. It's just to say that at best they will be a tokenism. But the reason I mention this is because, you know, when you draw from your imagination, you tend to reach for those archetypes which are most familiar, and they might not be those of the author. It's one of those marvelous bits of synthesis that happens when an author and illustrator collaborate on a book. When the chemistry is very good and each is left to sort of pursue their craft independent of the other, it can grow to something that often is more than just the sum total of two imaginations. And that's a wonderful thing about picture books, that I find, that you never know where the story is going to evolve, to what place it's going to evolve. It's that synergy that's created, that magical space, I like to think of it, between words and pictures, that renews my excitement every time I embark on a new picture book journey. You're entering into this vast unknown and not really knowing where the story will take you until you put pencil to paper and begin to chart a course. And so in creating the look of the characters that will come to define them, their world and how they see it, the myriad bits of illustration that support and tell the story, but also, you know, sometimes venture into stories of their own outside the confines of the text. Because what I think, you know, at the heart of it is that the illustrator's responsibility is not so much to the writer themselves, but to the tale they have created. And this might mean that the illustrated story goes off on tangents and directions that the writer, or maybe even the illustrator, may never have intended. Or it may not. And so each story, as you approach it as an illustrator, it has its own particular dictates, and therefore no template can be universally applied. Even when it comes to matters of style, it is only when the artwork, I think, is a perfect match for the tone of the tale that, in my opinion, a book will reach its full potential, a picture book. So, Blue Spruce. I think the Blue Spruce program is a fantastic addition to the Forest of Reading programs, and it was a real pleasure to have our book win in its inaugural year province-wide. Before the winner was announced, I had the opportunity to visit many schools and see the reaction and excitement generated by the program, and it was really gratifying. And so I just thought I would end my allotted 5 minutes here with a personal anecdote that, you know, in my mind sums up just the huge influence that this program has on Ontario primary students. And that's around the 2004 Blue Spruce Award ceremonies, which were held at a school west of Toronto in the middle of one of these sprawling subdivisions, you know, that are filled with new Canadians. And when we drove up to the school, jets were like booming overhead just a few hundred feet, because the school was built, even the whole subdivision was built just on the flight path, you know, the final approach into Toronto Airport. So we met in the auditorium, and the auditorium just filled up with hundreds of young faces, and most of them, you know, I don't even think they were entirely sure why they were there. but the neat thing that happened was before we actually got up and did the ceremony, they started to project the titles from the Blue Spruce program on this big screen at the front, one after the other. You know, the covers of the books would go up on this screen. And that, when the first one went up, first couple, the kids kind of quieted right down. And you can see them looking at it. And then you start hearing these gasps and cries of recognition. And then as they go on, you know, those become applause and cheering. And what I realized was, you know, here, this whole room of kids, they knew each of these books intimately because they just spent the previous few months reading them, talking about them, you know, understanding them. And I just thought, you know, what a wonderful testament to books and to reading, to the program itself. And it was just such a great experience to see so many kids, you know, so excited about books. And you know, and thanks to the Blue Spruce program and all the other Forest of Reading programs, too. So, yeah, that was great.
Thank you so much, Bill and Linda, and the 2004 Blue Spruce winners. You know, I had heard early on in my career that often the author and the illustrator don't meet each other prior to the end, the publishing of the book. Does that still happen? I mean, I'm an oldie, so that was an old story. That's really common. I can't believe, you know, how that can produce such good picture books. And maybe that's the difference between the winners and the other. I don't know. I mean, I don't even want to go there. I shouldn't have. However, I find that the symbiotic relationship that between the author and the illustrator is so important. And I thought about it again when you were talking about the students and going out and that relationship, the author, the student, the publisher, the teacher. I mean, we're all so important to the young minds. Okay, but Bill and Linda will be autographing books at the NBS autographing station at 12:30 today. You can purchase their books there and have them autographed upstairs in the exhibit area. I'd like to move along now to the winners of the 2004 Blue Spruce Award. First of all, in the fiction category, Newton and the Giant, the author Mike McGowan. Mike, this is his first novel, and I'll let him tell anything else that he'd like to tell. Come on up, Mike.
Thanks. We all know she meant the Silver Birch. I know. I was going to talk about this sort of by evolution, or the evolution of Newton and the Giant. When I started writing it, I really hoped it would be published, but you never know. It seems like an act of faith or an act of folly, whatever one you choose. And Newton had a hard time getting published. It sort of suffered a lot of rejection. Publishers didn't see the inherent genius of the book that I saw. It was a great day when HarperCollins said, we'd like to publish the book. And the book came out, and it's the marketplace is flooded, as you know. There's so many books coming out, and so it's so hard for them to vie for attention and, you know, whatever sort of dog and pony show we authors can do to help. But it seemed like it could have basically died in the vine. And I'll tell this one story, not to make myself sound too pathetic, but I went to a book festival, and I brought my family, my son, who was four at the time. We were kind of pumped up to go to this book festival, and we'd sort of driven a couple hours. And we got there, and there was maybe about 35 people sort of in attendance. And even worse, there was three other sessions going on. And one of the sessions had Gene Little, and there's two other powerhouse authors there. And Newton and John had just come out, and so we were in the green room. The session was supposed to start at 12 o'clock. And they're like, okay, we're just going to wait a couple more minutes. And we're like, okay, we're just going to wait a couple more minutes. And they're like, nobody's showing up. and it was one of those times. I felt bad for my son, and, you know, I'm a loser and all that kind of stuff. I didn't feel like that, but it certainly felt like, okay, maybe this book isn't going to have really any kind of life. And then getting nominated for the Silver Birch, I really didn't know about it at the time, but the publisher said, this is a big deal. And it turned out to be even a bigger deal than I could have imagined, because what it did for the book was really propel it. It allowed it to find an audience, and for me to go to schools to connect with readers. Like, even if I hadn't won the Silver Birch, it would have been a complete success because of the enthusiasm. Like, you'd go into school and there'd be a banner, "Welcome, Mr. McGowan," and, you know, that's the first time I've ever been called Mr. McGowan, so that was nice. And to be able to sort of talk about something that you are proud of and realize, like, hey, these kids are into the book, they like it, they're excited to see it, it's a big deal. And not sort of an ego-boosting thing, but the enterprise was worthwhile to do it. And as a writer who write, you know, you write in a vacuum hoping to find any kind of audience, it was really special. And then sort of to conclude, to make the loser story, like the happy ending, my son was there when I won the Silver Birch. I sort of thought, okay, at least you can come to see this thing, there'll be more people there. And, you know, to have won and to be able to celebrate that for the sales of the book, for the whole process of writing, it really couldn't have sort of been a better experience for me. And I really applaud the school librarians first of all, the OLA, and the school librarians for getting behind it and saying, hey, like, this is they make it a big deal, and, like, the parties you go to, and you're like, wow, these kids are really into this, and it's because of the people behind the program that make it so special. So, as a writer, I couldn't have been happier with the program. My experience was really a magical one, so I salute the OLA and thank you.
I didn't have too much time to talk to folks at breakfast, but Mike was telling me that he is a filmmaker as well, and he has a film, what is it called, Mike? Yeah, I think so. No, it's not on.
I'm going to speak for this. My producer pulled up. It's called Saint Ralph.
It's called St. Ralph. It debuted at the Toronto Film Festival. Stars Gordon Pinsent, Jennifer Tilly, and Campbell Scott. And it's coming out, I think, April 1st, a limited release, and then across the country. So on the first weekend, if you can go see it, it's a heartwarming story. You'll just love it, okay? Roper called it a magnificent gem, so there you go.
And those are the kinds of tidbits that we love to pick up. Thank you. And Mike will be autographing at 12 o'clock upstairs in the National Books, NBS area. Okay, moving on to the nonfiction award. A teacher, Larry Verstraete. And Larry? You're shaking your head, no, what did I do wrong? I'm not supposed to tell you that. Okay, welcome and congratulations on the fiction award for a nonfiction award for Silver Birch.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I have to confess another thing besides being a teacher. I'm also from Winnipeg, and really hadn't been to Toronto until the week of Silver Birch. Can you believe that? All my life I've kind of steered around Toronto, I think. Anyways, I've been back here a few times, and I really do enjoy it, and I should tell you that every time I come back, I learn something new. And today, in sitting around in conversation with people, I found out that you do not have block heater cords or block heaters, and that's a standard equipment in Winnipeg, I have to tell you that. The idea behind Survivors, actually, I think came from an experience I had 12 or so years ago when my family and I were on a camping trip in Colorado and decided to go for a hike one morning, and we'd asked the people at the campground where we could hike, and they kind of pointed to a mountain behind, and they said T-Shirt Mountain, and we decided that would make a nice little venture because T-Shirt Mountain had some kind of a name that meant we had to discover something. As it turned out, there was a T-shirt at the top of the mountain, and if you got up there, you could actually sign your name to it. So it was supposed to be a half-hour hike up to the top and maybe a little less coming down, and as we went up on the hike, the trail thinned, and we lost track of the trail, actually, but we knew where up was, and we managed to get to the top. And when we got up there, we looked around for the T-shirt and roamed around for quite some time and couldn't find the T-shirt at all, and decided it was time to come back down again because we were anxious to get on with our day. This was early morning. When we came down, I led my family, navigator that I am, off the wrong side of the mountain, and we quickly discovered within 15 or 20 minutes that we were lost, and we couldn't find a trail anywhere, and there was nothing to be seen anywhere. All we could see was bush and mountains all around us, and somewhere in the very far distance we could hear the hum of a highway, so we knew there was a highway somewhere out there. And being the inexperienced hikers that we were at the time, we didn't really carry anything with us on our journey up, including, you know, water or food or any of the other things that you think you should do. And things got pretty desperate at one point. After a couple of hours up there, not really knowing where we were or wondering if anybody would find us, my daughter was crying away, "We're going to die up here." And part of me felt that probably we were too, but I didn't tell her that. Eventually, anyways, we heard the sound of a creek in the distance, and we realized that the campground was near a creek. And by following the sound, we eventually found our way back to the campground. So I think in the back of my head, all these years, I've been thinking of that idea. And when a story appeared in the newspaper one day about a woman who had survived a hurricane, the idea for the book came from there. My experience and hers together meant that there had to be a lot of stories out there of people who survived various and assorted things. And that's basically what the book is about, 29 stories of individuals who survived everything from forest fires to tornadoes to, you know, the regular disasters. highlight of the book, I think, was actually speaking to a lot of these people and getting their story from them and walking away totally, you know, engaged with their story and marveling at their luck and often determination. I really found out that I was part of the Silver Birch program almost by accident. I was going on a Children's Book Week tour, and somebody had left me a phone message indicating that she was going to be my contact on the tour, and then somehow in her words I heard something about Silver Birch, and I had received no notification of that. So I thought, wow, well, maybe there's something to this. And I jumped on the internet to see if I could actually find out something, and what I found was a book review, the first one ever, of the book Survivors. It was not what I had expected. Actually, the book review was somewhat positive, but also had some less than glowing kinds of comments to go with it. And I was a little bit down because of that. And then I got a phone call from this teacher librarian telling me about the book tour, and she confirmed that I was on the Silver Birch list. Well, talk about a mixture of feelings that day. Down on one, ended up on the other, and I think that's pretty much the way I felt, quite torn. And as Linda pointed out, sometimes people are looking at different things in the book. And at one point, adults are probably looking for certain kinds of content, and kids are seeing something very different. So to win the Silver Birch for nonfiction means a great deal to me. It means that kids are actually reading the book and enjoying it, and that's primarily who it was for in the first place, I suppose. Somewhere, on one of my school visits, a teacher asked, "What has winning the Silver Birch meant to you?" And to be honest, I gave probably the poorest answer. I just was sort of struck off guard by that question, but it was a really good question. I think primarily it's meant that I've had lots of contact with kids who are reading the book, and I don't think you often get that as a writer. You're quite removed from that whole thing. So to actually be drawn into working with kids and to seeing them and see how eager they are about what they're reading is just an absolute high for the writer. And to get their questions and emails and letters and things like that and then to respond to them is a real treat too. And they had such good questions. Well, some of them were good. Some of them were like, "What is your favorite color and do you have pets?" And then there's the other end of, you know, where did you get your ideas from and did you interview these people and those kinds of questions. So all of that came to me. A highlight, I guess, of one of the school visits was the week of Silver Birch, going into schools, and there seemed to be a buzz about the book, and I didn't know what that meant. But to walk into a room of readers, grade 7 and 8 readers, 60 or 70 of them, and to ask them how many of you have read this book, and to have all of them put up their hands, is totally mind-boggling to me. And so I think that's what essentially this whole Silver Birch program is about. I know as a teacher, it takes a lot of work behind the scenes to make all of that happen. And I want to commend all those teachers who got their kids to read, because that's quite an achievement in itself. Thank you very much.
Sometimes I wish I could just take little clips of these conversations and take them to the Ontario Ministry of Education. Bill and Linda and Larry will be in conversation in room 206D at 9 o'clock, and Larry will be upstairs autographing at 11:30, so you can purchase his book and have it autographed there. Moving on to the Red Maple Award, and to its winner this year, Hit and Run, Nora McClintock. Nora, welcome back to the Forest of Reading program. I know it's not your first visit either. Welcome back.
Good morning. I'd like to thank the Ontario Library Association for giving me the opportunity to see my city this morning at a time when I would normally never see it. I'm a night person, not a morning person. I'm very happy to be here, and I really would like to thank the OLA for the opportunity to have participated last year in the Red Maple program. It's just such an amazing program. I have been involved a couple of times in the past, and there are two things about it that I particularly enjoy. One is the big final event that happens here in Toronto, where there are probably about 1,000 kids, all so enthusiastic and eager to meet every one of the authors who are there. That's always fantastic because, like a lot of writers, I spend a lot of time alone, so it's nice to get out there and meet some of the young readers. The second thing is that it generates a lot of email for me. I get a lot of email from kids who are just, you know, writing to say that they liked the book or could I answer a few questions. And I always appreciate hearing from readers. It doesn't matter what they want to ask me or what they want to say. But I also got a lot of email, and I continue to get a lot of email about Hit and Run and the subsequent books in this series from kids. The email usually starts, you know, "Dear Ms. McClintock, I really hate to read, but I had to read one of your books." This always perplexes me, you know, the circumstances under which a child might be required to read one of my books. But nonetheless, I read your book, and I really liked it, and I had to go and get another one. And that always, to me, is very gratifying because I know kids in grade 7 and 8, especially boys, don't necessarily choose reading as a pleasure activity, and certainly it's not top of the list. So when I get those emails from kids who actually enjoyed a book when they thought they were going to hate the experience and who decided that they wanted to read another book, that makes me feel like I've actually contributed something, especially given the genre in which I write. Which brings me to my book, Hit and Run. I've written quite a number of books. Usually, at the beginning, I set my books in Montreal, which is where I'm from originally, and then I started setting my books in a number of other places, but I actually live in downtown Toronto. I live out around the Greenwood and Danforth area, if you know Toronto, so on the Danforth. And I actually live right across the street from a high school. And right outside my front door, right across the street, there's a tree that is at the very extreme back of the high school, where presumably the, you know, authorities in school wouldn't see these children, young people, who sit around the tree at interesting times of the day, like, shouldn't they be in class? And they talk. And if I'm sitting outside of my porch, it doesn't seem to bother them. I was listening to these kids talk and saying all kinds of things that would make their mothers probably wonder where they had gone wrong. And it came to me that, you know, I've written books set in a lot of places, but I've never written a book set in Toronto. And I've certainly never written a book set in my neighborhood. And that's really the only idea I had in my head when I decided to write Hit and Run, is I wanted to write a book that was set in my neighborhood and that the main characters would be kids who are like those kids who sit across the street from my house under the tree generating clouds of noxious fumes and talking about things that their mothers would not like to hear. So I dreamed up this character, Mike, who is the main character in Hit and Run. And now, because I write murder mysteries, that's what I do, this required me to go on a hunt for a body to feature in this book. But fortunately, my neighborhood, I don't want to put it down, it's a really great neighborhood. I've lived there for 20 years now. I love it. But there's a lot that goes on in my neighborhood. And in fact, there was a really tragic story about a young mother who was crossing the street one day and who was a victim of a hit-and-run accident. And so I started to think about that and started to think about, you know, what might have being the long-term consequences of that to her family, and she had a couple of young kids, and you know, what happens to a kid when the mother is finally out of the picture, and what if there's no dad? And so that got me thinking about this particular character. And actually at one point I called the Children's Aid Society because I wanted to just sort of check some of my facts about what might happen. And I started to describe to this really nice woman there what happened to poor Mike in this story, you know, this tragic tale about his mother dying, and he was in the care of his uncle, who was very young at the time. His uncle was about 20 when the mother died. And I just started telling her the story, and she was like, oh my God, that poor boy is so traumatized. And I just didn't have the heart to tell her what happens after that, because things go downhill for Mike before he finally sees the light at the end of the tunnel. Anyway, I was very surprised. I wrote this book simply because I wanted to reflect my own little corner of the world. And I must say, I was very surprised that the young readers who read it responded the way they did. They really seemed to like this book. It made me very happy. And I've subsequently written a couple of more books about poor Mike. And they seem to be striking a similar chord. So I really want to thank the Ontario Library Association for the opportunity to get this book out there and for the opportunity for me to hear from so many kids who are generally pretty enthusiastic about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nora. And Nora will be autographing upstairs at 11 o'clock. And now we move on to the White Pine Award. And we've been out to Vancouver. We've heard from someone from Winnipeg. Now we're going to the other end of the country and introduce Don Aker, who comes to us from the East. And his book is underneath here, The First Stone, the winner of the White Pine Award. Bill? Don? This one has a star on it. That means green for white white pine.
I can't tell you how happy I am to be here and to have been selected even to participate in the 2004 White Pine, and to win was absolutely really the greatest thing, as you've heard from all these people. I have to tell you that was what it means to me. But you probably don't know if you know, but the Department of Education in Nova Scotia has not recommended the First Stone for classroom use because of the F word. And I'm going to make a blanket apology right now for that. Okay, I tried to avoid using the F word, but the characters Reef and Jink and Bigger. Just wouldn't say things like, oh gosh, you know, or darn. And I have the most wonderful agent, Leona Trainer, with the Transatlantic Literary Agency. And she's just this sweet, sweet, sweet woman. And I had this awful moment where I was putting the manuscript in the mail to her because I knew she'd have to read that part. And I wrote this big, you know, letter to warn her before she read it, and she said, look, you know, you just have to go with your gut, and that's what I did. And the thing is, I don't condone that language. I really don't. As a matter of fact, I'm really known as the Hall Nazi. I'm a teacher, and I teach grade 8, and I am the Hall Nazi, because if I hear anybody use any kind of profanity, I immediately stop them, and I say, you know, there are 500,000 words in the English language. Surely, to goodness, you can use a better one than the one I just heard. Give me 10. And they have to stand there and come up with 10 words they could have used, right? And I was telling the White Pine group last year that what I have been getting of late is, if I stop a student and berate them about their language, they'll say, page 84. So do know that I recognize the difficulty that book presents for librarians and for teachers. I'm really pleased to know that there are many, many teachers in Nova Scotia using it, despite the fact that it's not recommended. And I think in large part that has so much to do with the Ontario Library Association and the White Pine. I have to tell you, I was coming, I had this moment yesterday, I almost reduced to tears. I was in Halifax Airport, and I stopped in the bookstore. I always love to pick up a book before I travel, and I happened to wander by the teen fiction section, and all three of my novels are in the Halifax Airport bookstore. Never happened before in my life. Honest to God, you'd never find a book anywhere. You really wouldn't. And it's absolutely because of the Ontario Library Association. It would never have happened. I know my own mother has gone to the bookstore looking for my books, and she'll say, don't you know about this? And actually, when Mike told the story about the book signing, my very first book came out in 95, and it was called The Things Not Seen. Appropriate title, really. because it, you know, was very rarely seen. Anyway, I went to my first book signing, and I was so pumped. I didn't know. You know, I didn't know that, you know, nobody, well, of course, I didn't know that I chose to write for the only audience that doesn't buy books, right? I went to my book signing, and Halifax is word on the street, and I'm walking down the Spring Garden Road, and I see this tent where I'm going to be signing, and there are 45 plus people all lined up there, and I'm thinking, oh, yes! And the minute I sat down, they all left because they'd been there to see the Franklin, the illustrator. And so as soon as she finished signing, they and left. You know, everybody else did too. So there's my mother. You know. So anyway, I have a wife and two daughters, and they're incredibly supportive of me. And I know exactly what you're talking about when it comes to family and letting them down. I want to tell you that, interestingly, for those of you who are familiar with the book, I won't go through the, oh my God, that picture at the back is awful. Anyway, there's a little note about where the book came from, and I won't go into great detail, but a neighbor across the street from me, a retired woman and a widow, had two grown children living in Halifax. I live about a two-hour drive from Halifax, little town called Middleton. And her daughter would travel that 2 hours down to visit her mom almost every other week. And they would go do things together. They'd travel together. They'd go to movies together. They'd vacation together. They were just absolutely best friends. And one day a 17-year-old had stolen a van and was trying to get away from police, and he broadsided the daughter of my neighbor and killed her instantly. And that moment, I write about things. Someone asked me, what do you choose to write about? And I choose to write about things that bother me, that don't go away, that sort of keep me up at night, that keep me thinking and thinking. And for the longest time, I thought about that young man and what he must feel having, ended life and affected so many lives as well. And my neighbor eventually sold her home, and she moved into the city to live with her son, and it was just absolutely devastating. Anyway, this character in my head just wouldn't go away, and that is the character who became Reef. I was asked to speak at the